This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening and welcome to this event, tonight's event, In the Dark, Secrecy and Democracy, an examination of the question, in a democracy, can secrecy be justified in the name of national security? My name is Gail Jennings and I'll be your host this evening, and I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land upon which we're meeting, the Wurundjeri people from the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present, to any other elders who are present here tonight. So, we're in a very interesting point of political history right now. We're seeing quite a rapid move towards fairly heightened nationalism and the concomitant rise of populist leaders. And well, you've seen Britain deciding to Brexit, the emergence of Donald Trump, the electoral surges of Marine Le Pen and the election of Pauline Hanson and the somewhat confounding array of characters we have in our Senate. Now, the reasons for this might be many. The failure of market trickle-down, the economy, to actually provide for the non-elite, or perhaps it's the impact of digitalisation, which is denying access to a vast number of people to the radically altered industries, markets, power and jobs. But it's the pressure of 65 million displaced people tramping around the world and overseas seeking safety, and amongst them 21 million refugees, that's almost certainly been the fodder for the rise of populist leaders and nationalism, because it's fueling fear and disenchantment and turning it into xenophobia and a focus on border control, as you know. Tonight we have a special opportunity to examine how this shift towards heightened nationalism might alter the tenets and the values of the democracy that we've held dear to this point. Our three speakers have been brought specifically tonight to examine that question, and using Australia's asylum seeker policy as the case study to examine it. As you know, a functional democracy rests on the ability of people to hold, of the people, to hold sovereign power over the government and be able to scrutinise its operations and its decisions. And yet, in Australia, since the introduction of Operation Sovereign Borders in 2013 and the Border Protection Act last year, we've seen increasing secrecy around the implementation of asylum seeker policy and the effective muzzling of those who would seek to tell us what's really going on in our name. So tonight we're asking whether this culture of secrecy violates Australia's democracy and democratic values, what level of state secrecy we're willing to accept, and what happens when we don't know, or we don't wish to know, what our government is doing in our name. The format for tonight is that each of the speakers will speak for about 10 minutes. There's been some talk amongst them of sharing those minutes, and I'll be keeping a firm eye on it. And then we'll have 25 minutes of panel discussion and then 15 minutes of questions from the floor. There'll be people with microphones at the side for the last bit, and so they will sort you out, and I'll just say, next question, please. Now, I want to tell you that this event has been created by an organisation called Asylum Insight, and it's been brought to you in partnership with the Wheeler Centre. Asylum Insight is an independent, not-for-profit organisation that provides facts and analysis on Australian asylum policy with an international angle. It was established in Melbourne in 2013 and is committed to the principles of international human rights law, independence and informed public discourse. And there's a number of people from Asylum Insight here tonight, and if you want to join up for membership at the end, you can do so and you can see who they are, because they've got a big badge saying Asylum Insight. And I should warn you let you know that tonight will be recorded. Okay, so let's start. Our first speaker is Madeleine Gleeson. She's a lawyer and research associate at the Calder Centre at the University of New South Wales. She specialises in international human rights and refugee law, with a focus on the law of state responsibility, the extraterritorial scope of human rights obligations, offshore processing, and the protection of children. She's worked in Cambodia, South Africa, Indonesia, and with the UNHCR. She's author of the book Offshore, Behind the Wire on Manus and Nauru, and that book will be for sale later at the back of the room. Please welcome Madeleine Gleeson.
Thank you very much, Gail, and thank you also to Asylum Insight and the Wheeler Centre for bringing us all here today. So I believe my role tonight is to start setting the scene, but in true lawyerly style, I might start with a digression and start talking about language first before getting to any real substance. And I was going to start by examining this word secrecy, because I think it's important to note up front that secrecy is not necessarily in itself a problematic or a negative thing. States do have not only a right, but in fact obligations to protect the people in their territory from all sorts of harms. And secrecy may very well be a necessary component of that in certain circumstances. And in the refugee context in particular, secrecy, when understood as privacy or confidentiality, can be a really crucial component of ensuring the protection of people who have come here while their claims are being assessed, to ensure that their identities are kept secret, that their claims are kept secret so that neither they nor anyone back home might suffer any retribution. So secrecy is not necessarily a negative thing in itself. But at the other end of the spectrum, we have some of the things that we've started to see in this country: the gagging of whistleblowers, the silencing of doctors, say, preventing them from reporting cases of abuse, a firm blanket of secrecy over all aspects of our asylum policy without exception, even when it might be in the public interest to know what is happening, which is very much moving well into the territory of something that's very problematic and very negative as soon as we start talking about democratic ideals. So the question becomes, I guess, where do you draw the line? At what point does secrecy become unacceptable? At what point does it become dangerous to democracy, as opposed to an essential part of the state function? Since tonight I'm bringing the international law perspective, I was thinking about this and thought it might be useful to draw on a well-established principle of international law and in domestic legal systems, including it's really at the heart of many aspects of Australian law as well. And it's a principle that's often used to explain when it is acceptable to derogate from someone's rights, when it is acceptable for a state to, say, hold someone in detention or to infringe on their rights in some way. And the question is the measure necessary, reasonable, and proportionate to a legitimate purpose? This is very familiar language to lawyers in the international level, at the Australian level. They're tests that lawyers have debated long and hard in various contexts. And the very first step is identifying what is a legitimate purpose. So back to my first example, where the purpose is to protect someone's identity for the sake of safety, that is a legitimate purpose. If the legitimate purpose is for a political party to maintain power or to exclude the public from fair and free decision-making about something that's being done in their name, I think that's when we start to question whether that is really a legitimate purpose that would justify a measure infringing on people's rights to freedom of speech and their right to freely participate in the democracy of their country. Even if a legitimate purpose is identified, and national security may well, in many cases, be one of those legitimate purposes, there still remains the test of whether the measure, whether the secrecy measure is, as I said, necessary, reasonable, and proportionate. And what that requires is a look to whether there is any alternative action that could have been taken to achieve the same purpose without infringing so much on people's rights, without being so secretive and having such a lack of transparency. So that's going to be my approach, I think, to the provocation tonight, is really coming back to that test. And there are three contexts that I thought I'd raise for you that where we can really test how this applies and show the different types of secrecy that we're dealing with. The first is in the case of turnbacks at sea, or takebacks. Australia conducts two separate operations. The first is a turnback, which is where boats of asylum seekers coming to Australia are brought back to, say, the territory, the line of Indonesian territorial waters, and then sent in the direction of Indonesia. The second is a take-back, and that is when people are physically handed over into the sovereign custody of another state, notably Sri Lanka or Vietnam. That might occur at sea, or people might be brought to Australia and then flown back. But either way, these two types of operations are shrouded in a very tight veil of secrecy. This is a complete blackout of information. And we can imagine how motivated people are to get to Australia once they've risked their lives on a boat. So there are very real questions about what is being done to convince someone to turn around back at sea, given that they came so motivated. And the militarisation of these efforts really adds to that secrecy and that blackout of information. A different type of secrecy operates in terms of our offshore processing in Nauru and Manus, because by now it's very difficult for anyone, I'm sure, in this room or this country to say they haven't heard a single thing about what's happening there. The stories have come out again and again and again. There have been multiple leaks, multiple stories. We've all heard a lot. It's almost a different type of secrecy, and it's secrecy through misinformation. It's a secrecy through distorting the lines of communication so that whatever we hear, we're not quite sure if someone has an agenda, where the truth really lies, and how to reconcile completely different lines of information that we're given. The outcome is the same. Very few people can say with certainty that they know what is happening offshore. But it's not for a blackout of information. It's for a lack of the ability to really interrogate the information that is coming out of those two centres. Often the physical separation of people to other countries and the fact that they're within the sovereign territory of those countries is perhaps used as an excuse for why we don't really know what's happening. But that moves me on to the third category, I guess I would say now, in setting the scene, and that is onshore detention centres, including, quite worryingly, the MITRE, which is based right here in Melbourne. We don't know what's happening inside those centres either. And at that point, there isn't the same excuse of this being in another country or this being in the sovereign territory of somewhere else. Whatever's happening in that centre is happening in the same city as we all live today. And so how come we don't know what's coming out of that either? It's a little bit of everything I've already said. It's the militarisation of the whole activity. It's closing it up behind closed walls. It's dehumanising the people in there so that they don't seem like real people. But I think there is another question to be asked about why something occurring so close to where we are now remains secret too. So I think I might leave it at that sort of setting of the scene.
Thank you very much, Madeline Gleeson. Our second speaker is Dr. Dennis Muller. He's a leading expert on media ethics, and he's worked as a journalist for 27 years as assistant editor and associate editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, respectively. Not all those years as an editor. For the past 20 years, he's conducted independent social and policy research, including two studies of public attitudes to immigration and asylum seekers. Dennis teaches media ethics in the Masters of Journalism program at the University of Melbourne and is the author of many books, including the latest Journalism Ethics for the Digital Age. Please welcome Dennis Muller.
Well, in the typical way of the university academic, I've made slides, haven't I? So you put up with that. Thank you very much, Gail, and thank you to the Wheeler Centre for this very interesting platform. I'm going to talk about this from the media ethics perspective. And in the context of the asylum seeker issue, the media, I think, have four primary ethical obligations. I put them up there, and there's no point in my reading them out. But you'll see that they begin with an obligation to truth-telling. And in the context of the asylum seeker issue, truth-telling has three aspects. Firstly, finding out what's going on. Secondly, verifying information prior to publication, I emphasise prior, and identifying and resisting propaganda. Now, finding out what's going on confronts the media in this particular situation with an immediate challenge. One of Madeline's types of secrecy, the secrecy imposed by government in the name of national security. And from a media ethics perspective, secrecy can be justified in the interests of national security, but not necessarily in the name of national security. And I think that there is a world of difference between the two. From a media ethics perspective, the interests of national security exist only in relation to substantive national security concerns, and Madeline has enumerated some of them, as well as, of course, issues concerning individual privacy. And these are generally thought of as affecting the territorial integrity of the nation and the safety of the population, the welfare of the armed forces, those kind of considerations. From a media ethics perspective, these criteria concerning substance are not met simply by a government's declaring something is a national security issue. That's the meaning I take from the phrase, in the name of national security. A mere assertion by government that something is a matter of national security doesn't make it so. It may or may not have substance. The media have an ethical duty to test such an assertion, just as it is the media's job to test all assertions by government and others in power. In the asylum seeker context, the mere fact that the Australian government declared its Stop the Boats policy to be matters of national security gave it a military sounding name, Operation Sovereign Borders, rebranded the Customs Service with fancy badges and police look-alike uniforms. None of this meets the test of what it means to be in the interests of national security. It's just propaganda, a political expedient for attempting to justify secrecy while at the same time demonising asylum seekers as enemies of the state. Now, when the media perceive such action by government, they're ethically bound to challenge it, to attempt to reveal it for what it is, to penetrate the secrecy and tell the population what's going on behind the veil. That is fundamental to the media's role in the democracy. You keep people up to date with what's going on, give them information, hold governments to account, in a sense, empower people to be the sovereign people. And it includes, of course, trying to find out what's going on the so-called on-the-water operations and in the detention centres. The second aspect of truth-telling is verification. We live in what's being called a post-truth age. Gail referred to this in passing, an age of untruth or truthiness, as it's being called. And it's developed largely, I think, as a consequence of social media, which has empowered anyone with the skills of basic literacy and access to the internet to publish. And alongside the cynicism that's grown up among the population and the resultant disillusionment with government, exemplified by things that Gail mentioned, the Trump and the Hansen phenomena to mention too, and I might mention that we now are said to laugh at our politicians and listen to our comedians. In this atmosphere of cynicism, this capacity to spread misinformation, disinformation, gossip and rumour has created a political atmosphere in which even mad lies, such as Pauline Hanson's statement that Australia is being swamped by Muslims now, gain some degree of currency. Elements of the professional media have been irresponsible in allowing themselves to be sucked into this vortex of untruth by giving further amplification to online material without first verifying that it's true. There's a mantra you hear from some journalists in a broader context than this, and it goes like this: if it's wrong, it won't be wrong for long. In other words, if it's all right to get it wrong and put it up online because someone will see it and you can fix it pretty quickly. Well, that is simply a gross breach of professional ethics. And above all, it's a breach because democracy needs reliable information and it needs myth-busting. And it's the role of the media to do both. The second of those obligations I mentioned was the obligation to the public interest. And in the context of the asylum seeker issue, it's well to bear in mind that public interest is not the same as public curiosity, though sometimes they overlap, but it exists where the public have a definable stake in the matter. And in this particular case, I've put a list on the wall there, which I think demonstrate the foundations of the substantive stake that the public have in this issue. I'm not going to read them all out, but you can see that it has to do with Australia's being a signatory to the Refugee Convention, that its current activities are in breach of that, that we've got taxpayer money being spent on these camps in the territories of two friendly governments, in PNG and Nauru. We've got the Navy deployed at sea. There's a whole raft. Oh, my God. Sorry, Dr. Freud. There's a great long list of good grounds for asserting public interest. Now, in the event that national security was genuinely at stake, then that would add another public interest dimension that we would have to weigh in the balance against those other seven that I've listed there. But as I've argued, national security is not genuinely at stake here. And the third obligation is to protect confidences. It is true that much of what we know, as Madeleine adverted to, Much of what we know about what goes on in those offshore detention centres, and to some extent what goes on at sea, comes from whistleblowers who've supplied information to the media in confidence. And the media have an unbreakable ethical duty to protect confidential sources. It's one of the very few kind of iron laws in media ethics. At the Centre for Advancing Journalism, reporters on our online newspaper, The Citizen, received a leak, as many other media outlets did, about conditions in one of the offshore detention centres. They were placed under intense pressure, including legal pressure, to return the leaked material, but doing so would have revealed the identity of the confidential source, and so they refused. We arrived at settlement, we published the material, and then it was destroyed and not returned. But of course, this raises a further ethical dilemma for journalists. Under what circumstances is it acceptable to receive material that's been unlawfully leaked? And the answer for a journalist is to pit it against the public interest test. Is the public interest in this matter so great as to outweigh the wrong involved in unauthorised disclosure? Part of that assessment is to consider the motives of the leaker for wanting the material ventilated and the motives of the government for wanting it kept secret. In this case, it was obvious that the leaker wanted the information out because of a view that the public really ought to know what's being done in its name. And the motive of the government wanting to keep it secret is to prevent embarrassment and political opprobrium. Nothing to do with national security. No claim for national security or the imperiling of it was made, for instance, when Dr. David Young, the psychiatrist, gave evidence in an inquiry in which he likened the treatment of some of the people on those detention centres to torture. There was no claim of national security breach, but the federal police went after him, looked at his telephone records, questioned some of his colleagues. And why? The AFP said the Immigration Department wanted the matter investigated because it involved a leak of Commonwealth information. No mention of national security. So by now, it's beyond doubt that this was never a matter of national security, isn't to this day. It follows then that the competing public interest considerations I listed earlier trump any national security claim. What an unfortunate name, Trump. In the asylum seeker issue then, media are ethically obliged to hold government to account and to do so in the face of bogus claims that national security is at stake. Considering the strong public interest in disclosure, to yield to the government's secrecy would be to become complicit in an exercise in censorship for which there is no substantive justification.
Thank you, Dennis Muller. Our third speaker is Raymond Gaiter. Ray is a professorial fellow in the Melbourne Law School and the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne and Professor Emeritus of Moral Philosophy at King's College, London. He holds an honorary doctorate from the University of Antwerp for his exceptional contribution to contemporary moral philosophy. And he's the author of many best-selling books, including the one you will all know, Romulus, My Father, which was made into a feature film of the same name, and most recently, After Romulus, Who's Afraid of International Law? Please welcome Raymond Gaiter.
Gail, and thanks to the Wheeler Centre for inviting me. It's nice to be back in this splendid room. I agree with most of what Madeline and Dennis have said, so I'll speak only briefly about that common ground. Is our national security threatened by even large numbers of boat arrivals? The answer to that, I think, is no. The way the expression border protection is used, as this has been mentioned by both Madeline and Dennis, creates the illusion that national security might be at issue, as does the tendency to speak of asylum seekers as illegal immigrants. Recall that John Howard said that we will choose who comes to this country. Well, you can say that about immigrants, but not about people seeking asylum, because we are a signatory to the Refugee Convention. We are, amongst other things being equal, obliged to accept refugees. It's not a matter of choice, not a matter of choosing, for example, which of them best suits our domestic interests. Well, in the next few minutes, I won't say much directly about secrecy or democracy, not until the end. Instead, I'll sketch a conceptual landscape in which I hope to locate how we might look at them. Firstly, following on from my last point, our borders are not being penetrated in the way that, for example, America's borders are. Asylum seekers don't try to hide in the country undetected. Overwhelmingly, they give themselves up for assessment as refugees. Secondly, even if many of them did hide in the community, the security of the nation would not then be threatened, not even if some of them were terrorists who then successfully prosecuted attacks. If that happened, the lives of Australians would, of course, be at risk, but not the security of the nation, even if many lives were lost. And that distinction might shock you, so I'll try to explain why it matters a great deal to make it. Since 9/11, and especially since the dramatic formation of ISIS, we've constantly been told that we're at war. If we are at war, and we're undeniably caught up in an armed conflict, then we must remember that terrorists don't and never will have the means to destroy us as a nation. And for that reason, and many others, of course, it can be misleading to call the war against terror, I mean, in inverted commas, the war against terror, a war of self-defence. That equivocates between an arguably overriding obligation on politicians to protect the conditions under which the nation, as a distinctive political entity defined by particular institutions and way of life, can survive into the future, that on the one hand, and on the other hand, their obligation to protect the lives of their citizens. The latter obligation is a serious one, of course, but it can be and always has been overridden in certain circumstances. To see this, we need only remember that while politicians have a defining obligation to protect the lives of their citizens, they are also obliged to send thousands of them sometimes, and sometimes conscripts, to fight and die in wars, not so that more lives will be saved than would otherwise be lost. I mean, what a cock-up the Second World War would have been if that were true. They do it to protect the institutions of citizenship, the rule of law, democracy, and so on, as these might be relatively interchangeable between different countries, but also, and this point is very important, to protect those institutions as they are infused with the spirit of a particular people by their history, their language, their art, their poetry, their song, all indeed things that fall under the vague expression way of life. Terrorists threaten our lives. They do not threaten the values that we hold dear. Only we do that. If, in order to save our lives, we seriously degrade institutions that we cherish, the very institutions that an aggressor would destroy if we were to be occupied, then I do not believe we can plead that we did so or do so under the pressure of political, moral, or any other necessity that could justify us. We will have forsaken what we cherish, what we had taken pride in, what had in large part defined our cultural and political identity, for no better reason than the fact that we lack civic courage. And we know that our enemy carries out terrorist attacks, hoping that we lack that courage. Well, our politicians say in this regard that we must find the right balance between national security and the national interest on the one hand, and civil liberties, transparent government, and human rights on the other. Sometimes, on emotional occasions, they say something different. On the day when the Charlie Hebdo journalists were murdered in Paris, Tony Abbott said, "We will defend our values. What we can never do is compromise our values in defending them." I don't know if he also said, "Je suis Charlie," but the many millions who did meant what he said on that day. Yet less than a week later, he said that we had to find trade-offs between civil liberties, respect for human rights, and community safety. And later, politicians in Paris and Brussels said exactly the same, or did the same. Well, if you put a kilo on one side of scales and 1 kilo on one side of scales and 2 on the other, you know which way the scales will tip. And if they don't, you throw away your scales. That's because kilos are not ethically contested units. But justified use of the metaphor of weighing conflicting considerations about ethical and politically complex issues depends on a degree of agreement about the moral and political values that are to be put on the scale or traded off that does not exist in Australia or other Western democracies. Some people believe and stick with the belief that Abbott first expressed, which means that they think that as things stand for us, I'll elaborate that qualification in a discussion if you want, as things stand for us, there is nothing to weigh up. They will say, as I suggested earlier, that the risk to our lives is not yet a reason to compromise our values, that the argument to the contrary should be regarded as the voice of temptation rather than of political sobriety and realism, that to yield to it should be cause for national shame. Others believe we should bring on the scales and quickly. But that is exactly the kind of difference that makes the metaphor of weighing in this context conceptually incoherent. That's the first landmark of the conceptual landscape I'm sketching to which I draw attention. The second is nearby. It's called the national interest. Some people believe that it's sentimental to hold nations to account morally for their conduct towards one another, especially when they're at war or engaged in armed conflict, as we are now with ISIS. They believe that for the sake of the national interest, for the sake of the common national good, we should, if necessarily, severely curtail the rights of suspected terrorists and even be prepared to torture them, if that would save many lives. They believe that the concept of the national interest marks a morality-free zone. For other people, however, the concept of the national interest is inseparable from the conditions under which a politically serious person could love their country lucidly and without shame. For them, moral considerations are intrinsic to an enriched, politically serious and realistic conception of the national interest. They say, we are not pleading for a moral constraint on the pursuit of the national interest. We are offering a conception of the national interest from which morality just can't be separated. And that's one of the things that for them distinguishes love of country from its false semblance, jingoism, from the ugly kind of nationalism that secured Brexit and shows itself in frightening ways in Europe, the US, and to a lesser but nonetheless troubling extent in Australia. Who would have believed, even a couple of weeks ago, that 49% of Australians want to stop Muslim immigration? I introduced just now the distinction between love of country and jingoism for two reasons. Firstly, because it's conservative politicians who speak of love of country and of pride in what our soldiers have done to protect the national interests. But if you feel pride in what your defence forces have done, you ought to be prepared in certain circumstances, if the distinction between love of country and jingoism matters to you, also to feel ashamed of what they've done, and to be prepared for the sake of seeing justice done to their victims, to render them answerable to an international tribunal. Render them and us, I mean the nation, answerable to an international criminal court. That is anathema, as we all know, to most conservative politicians. But by the same token, the refusal of many on the left to take seriously the need most human beings have for roots, realised in national forms, has been one of the causes of Brexit and the development of ugly right-wing national paranoia more generally. Because the left generally has not been prepared to take seriously talk of love of country, fearing, with a lot of justification, that it always declines into ugly and often murderous forms, it has not taken seriously the question, how can we prevent love of country from degenerating into jingoism? And what kind of road can we build on which jingoism might find its way to love? This is a fundamental duty for the future because the need people have for roots will not go away anytime soon, nor will the fact that in the foreseeable future, only the nation state, usually in coalition with other nation states, has a necessary military force to protect those roots. Finally, now I come to secrecy. Obviously, governments need sometimes to be secretive. We all agree on this. But obviously, too, they must not abuse that need. Whatever one thinks of Assange and Snowden, one must, I think, acknowledge that they prove beyond doubt that democratic governments have abused that need and therefore betrayed the trust of their citizens, a trust that must be earned if democratic politics is not to degenerate into the kind of cynicism that regards the phrase political dignity to be an oxymoron. But if I'm right that the need to love one's country without shame should be intrinsic to an enriched, ethically enriched conception of the national interests, and if the desire for a truthful love of country is partly, but essentially, what distinguishes genuine love of country from jingoism, then the need for truth and the need for trust when truth is justifiably withheld is fundamental to the ethically enriched conception of the national interest that I sketched earlier. In the periodic table, Primo Levi spoke of his disgust and his despair at the degree to which the fascists polluted the political life of Italy with their lies during World War II. Polluted is his word. We speak naturally of the ways lies can pollute, poison, defile, or degrade things which are precious to us, relationships, institutions such as universities or the press, and sometimes the entire political life of a nation. Indeed, you can describe something as polluted or defiled only if you think it's precious. Amongst people for whom truthfulness is fundamental to their conception of political dignity, truth is precious. But it can be precious to them too as individual human beings. In times of conflict, when our fellow citizens are killed in battle or by terrorists, we grieve for them as citizens, and some of us just as human beings who love them. No one wants to grieve in cloud cuckoo land, just as no one wants their pride or their love to be based on lies. That's why truth is both a need of the political realm, of lucid patriotism, and of the soul. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have the legal framework, the media ethics, and the philosophical values all rolled up in three people and separated to some extent. I just want to start by the ground. So in summary, the panel has agreed that, in fact, the secrecy surrounding Australia's asylum seeker policy does violate Australia's democratic values. Yeah. Right, okay, so we're there. So I'd like you to please paint us the scenario of where the road to jingoism is actually taking us, do you think? Madeline, where do you think it's taking us?
I think it's taking us in the asylum context.
Yes.
Towards a very bad place.
Well, actually, and more generally as well, but yes.
Absolutely, more generally too. But in the asylum context, just to keep our attention on the specific people, we've already seen in 4 years where it's taken us with offshore processing. From asylum seekers who came here with some resilience to the devastation that we now see offshore. I shudder to think where it will take us 5 years from now, turning back, looking back on a policy of turnbacks, what we'll discover about what is happening and what will happen in our name if we don't know. But your question is the right one and an interesting one, because what happens in the immigration context is not separate. It's not isolated. It absolutely bleeds into every other aspect of Australian democracy and the way that our institutions are functioning. So when you start having this clampdown of secrecy, a say-so that something is suddenly militarised, something is suddenly national security without going through the proper checks, when you have power being concentrated in a certain minister acting on his or her own discretion, that absolutely affects the way all of our institutions operate and should be a very real concern to all Australians.
Okay, thank you. Dennis?
Well, I think it's primarily divisive. It is divisive of our nation. I think that it brutalises public sentiment. It, in a sense, inures us to the real horrors that are being done in our name. Because we think these are in some way justified by this, I think, perverse definition of the national interest, to pick up on some of the things that Raymond has said. I think that it is a challenge to our multicultural ideal. I think it is, in a sense, it is a threat to the vision of Australia that we have developed for ourselves. So it begins to change the picture in our heads about what the Australian nation looks like. So I think it is, you know, fundamentally an evil influence.
And Ray, would...
Well, I agree with all that. Mm. I might just add that even if one thinks, as, for example, dear friend of mine, Robert Mann, has argued that one needn't on principle oppose turnbacks, and one needn't on principle oppose offshore processing. But one should, not just on principle, but just by any standard of decency, oppose the hellholes of Manus and Nauru. And Madeleine was quite right to emphasise that we ought to be ashamed not only of things that go on there, but things that go on here in this town. What I find particularly depressing is that though there have been these attempts at secrecy, they have, as Madeleine pointed out, not been terribly successful. And why I find that depressing is that it seems to me to show that the reason people are not opposed to this is not because they don't know or have grave suspicions which they should follow up on, but because they don't care. And that's even perhaps a deeper reason for shame for all of us. When I say we, I mean the we that Keating used when he said, we did the killings, we did the... And so he didn't invite someone to say, hey, not so fast, not me, I didn't. I mean, it's an expression of national fellowship where you just accept responsibility, even if you fought very hard to stop those conditions.
Can I ask, though, whether that might be a function of... The post-true media, the propaganda, the is it because people know and don't care, or is it because they've been conditioned not to care because they've been frightened by spin and by, you know, like, how do we get into this whole unholy mess?
I don't think it's that, because let's put it this way, even if they're frightened because they fear that terrorists might come in and so on. And granting that we all have irrational fears, you know, as I think someone said, we have more chance of being killed falling off our chairs than by a terrorist attack. Granting all that aspect of irrationality in our fears, the fact that people don't pull themselves together over this is a sign that they don't care too about, as it were, the nature of civil society. And I think... This is an expression of a kind of developing political literacy. I mean, it shows in all sorts of ways. For example, that we always talk of running the country instead of governing people. Even someone like Obama, during the election campaign with Romney, never bothered to ask why anybody should think that being a very successful businessman should qualify him for running a country.
You mean Trump?
No, this was Romney. Even for taking an economic post, because governing the economic life of citizens is not the same as running an enterprise. So we've yielded the sort of language of citizenship for a very, very long time. And it's against that loss that these other things occur.
Madeleine?
I agree with all of that, and I think what exacerbates it is 20 years now of appalling rhetoric, really, and framing of the issue when it comes to asylum seekers and refugees in this country. And it's very difficult to undo 20 years' worth of that. But by, 20 years of appealing to the fear and appealing to the negatives and using the language and all of that, instead of tapping into some sort of national pride over, Australia was instrumental in drafting a lot of the agreements which now operate, which make up our human rights law framework. We've been at the forefront of all sorts of incredibly important humanitarian efforts around the world and continue to be today. And instead of tapping into that national pride over the very good things that we've done and the fact that we are a welcoming place for people who've come across the seas, as our anthem says, we tap into fear. And so it builds on all of that and becomes incredibly difficult to rewind. Dennis?
You mentioned in the introduction to my little bit that I'd done two studies on public attitudes to this. One was in 1997. It was commissioned by the then Department of Immigration and Multicultural Affairs. Doesn't that sound quaint? And the other was, and that was in 1997, trying to understand what lay behind the Hansen phenomenon of that time. And the other was conducted in September last year, was commissioned by the Melbourne Social Equity Institute just to find out what was going on in relation to asylum seekers. And I found some very similar threads across those decades. And the really big one was that those who were most implacably opposed to, in 1997, Asians, which we were then being swamped by, and today by Muslims, which we learn we're also being swamped by, the common factor was a sense of being left out of Australian society, of having lost a stake. It came back in 1997 to those who'd lost out as a consequence of the fairly radical economic reforms of the Hawke and Keating period. And it's a similar situation now. People feel that their stake in society is being whittled away and that these newcomers will compete with them for a stake, and that will play out in competition for pensions, for hospital beds, for school places, and that they, as battling taxpayers, will be funding the welfare of these asylum seekers who are regarded as always a net drain on the economy and a threat they won't fit in. So you can hear the echoes across the decades.
Mm. Did you want to add something, Madeline? No.
No, I mean, I completely agree. Yeah. And even though it flies in the face of the established research and the economic modelling, which shows the incredible benefit that these people can be and have been to Australian society, you can have all of the research papers and economic models in the world, but it takes something else for that to resound with the public.
Absolutely.
It's true to say, though, that the present government was voted in by the people who are supposed to have the sovereign power over the government, and the government had the policies in place when they were voted in, and so therefore do they have a mandate, and maybe they're upholding their elected responsibility? What would be your response to that?
Well, as a political scientist, I question mandate theory from its foundations.
If I take away the word mandate, can we go with the
but even assuming for a minute that asylum seekers were a large issue for most people in the most recent election. Wasn't true in 2010, 2013. It was a huge issue. It was much less of an issue this time. But the fact that the two main parties are more or less identical makes it very difficult to see whether they preferred the particular Liberal brand of cruelty to the Labor brand of cruelty. So I'm not at all sure that you could argue a mandate.
I completely agree. This wasn't a major issue in this election, and so to say that someone was elected in on a range of other policies does not mean you've got carte blanche to do whatever you want offshore, especially when, getting back to the topic of this discussion, there is so much secrecy. The vast majority of Australians do not fully understand what is happening. I know there have been a lot of leaks, there's a lot of stories in the newspaper, but that doesn't equate to properly understanding what's being done in your name. So, no, I don't think it means the government's got the right to do whatever they like.
And Ray?
Well, I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, as I said, I don't believe that the reason there's not a sort of uprising against this kind of policy is because people are ignorant of what's going on. I think it's because they don't care about what's going on. So if it comes to a matter of what governments have a right to do by virtue of what the expressed will of the people, then I think the government can safely say, look, neither in our case nor in the case of the preceding government did people object whatsoever to what's been going on. And I find this both depressing and puzzling, actually.
Well, does that take us back to the reason why democracies were created? Do we have a moral obligation to try to hold to some kind of values that provide dignity and trust and love?
I think absolutely. And the point has been made that there's a difference between the public curiosity, did you put it, and the public interest. I think on a lot of these things, it might be going too far to say that the entire Australian public has a right to know every detail. But if not the Australian public, then independent authorities, trusted bodies, trusted reviewers should have full access so that they can report back to the public about what's going on. I think that would be a very crucial first step. Mm. It is important.
Dennis, do you have...
Well, I thought Ray wanted to say something, so...
No.
If you think back to the idea of the sovereign people, John Locke's idea, to make that real, and that's really the foundation of modern democracy, to make that real, then people need information, but you can't... you can supply information, and lots of journalists have, by overcoming the government secrecy in this way. But you can't, just by giving them information, change their hearts necessarily. People need to, first of all, want to absorb the information, and then they need to consider whether it's going to change their minds. Now, for a lot of people, that they are two quite big steps. Because, you know, Ray, I think, rightly has said, you know, it's a question of caring. To what extent are people, a lot of people, actually engaged in this? And I think the answer from my research is not very deeply. And part of the evidence for that is that myths abound. When I did these focus groups all over Australia, you kept hearing the same myths, the myths including that... firstly, the proportion of the Muslim population in Australia is 9 times greater than it really is. People think it's about 80%. And secondly, that they're given gifts of large sums of money. $20,000 is commonly mentioned. And a pair of Nike shoes, strangely enough, seems to be one of the current myths. Now, these myths gain currency because people don't engage in the information which is available to them. And that is partly to do with not caring and partly to do with the distractions of ordinary life, and perhaps an incapacity to empathise, to actually see the world from the point of view of the asylum seeker, coupled with a deeply rooted belief that Australia is by miles the best country in the world, who wouldn't want to live there, and no appreciation at all of Ray's point about people's roots. People don't want to leave Syria, but a lot of Australian people can't grasp the idea that anyone would want to live anywhere else except in Australia, and so there's this ravening horde at the gates, and if we let them budge an inch, we'll be swamped.
Mm. I think if I could just add to that, it's also the misfortune of our geography, I think, which plays a large role. If we compare to the people of Greece, and especially when Greece was facing particularly dire economic circumstances, they had their own issues to grapple with. But as boats pulled up to those islands, the story after story of people just barreling into the sea and physically helping people out of there, stripping their own children naked to clothe a baby that's just been pulled out of the ocean. And they've just recently, all sorts of civil society actors won all sorts of awards and recognition of the incredible work they did. That doesn't mean that all Greeks have a different, a united positive view on this, but they get to physically see the people coming in. So in that sense, whatever secrecy you could achieve is lessened because they've seen it with their own eyes. Mm. In Australia, we don't see boats coming in. We don't see people pulling in on trains to the central train stations. And so we are entirely reliant on not only the facts, but also how they're framed. And what we've seen in how they've been presented and framed is that we get to Ray's point that people don't care because it's not in our faces and it's not real.
Can I ask then what the point of, not the point of democracy is, but like we're signatories and parties to a whole range, and as you said, have actually helped craft a whole range of United Nations and human rights conventions, almost all of which have been contravened by our asylum seeker policy. And the Australian people know this, and yet nothing has actually happened to us because of that. And our Prime Minister has just been the first Global Assembly of the United Nations speaking with pride about our border protection policies. Why would we bother to have a United Nations in this case when we're so grossly offending against all the covenants?
I guess going back to our secrecy point, there is always a difference between what is said on the public stage, especially at the UN, and what actually happens behind the scenes. So the fact that certain statements might be said publicly, while very worrying, does not mean that our government has absolutely no regard whatsoever for international law. In fact, in many of the ways in which our government behaves and previous governments have behaved shows very real concern. I mean, it governs the way we interact with all of our neighbours and it governs the way we interact with the world. There is strong recognition that it's important. However, there does seem to be a perception that it's possible to just suspend it when it comes to Australia's border protection policy, as it's put. And it does seem to be because there is a genuine belief that what we're facing is a national security threat and that that justifies the suspension of these obligations. But I think, as we've all agreed on this panel, that's not true and it doesn't justify it.
Dennis, Ray?
I don't think I have anything to add.
I have some reservations about that because I think people's thoughts about international law as it has to do with these kinds of matters. We're sort of prior to the immigration crisis of Europe, I think. I think we're sort of thoughts about immigration, asylum and so on, before that are different from what they now are in many people's minds, and should be, actually. Because I think we should think of what's happened in Europe as a harbinger of what's to come in all sorts of ways. I mean, let me put it more carefully. We have reason to fear that more people will be uprooted this century than ever before. By things like happening in Syria, and by things affected by climate change and so on. Therefore, I think, what's brought to us? Let me put it this way: we have to go right to basics and try to answer for ourselves. Try to develop a legal and political way of thinking which is responsive to this question. What do we do with the fact that a very small portion of the earth enjoys the fruits of the earth? Through sheer luck. Nothing else but luck. That they are born in a particular place. And the majority of the people of the earth suffer the miseries that end also just because they are born in a particular place. That at least has to make us rethink the distinction we draw between people just fleeing persecution and people suffering the miseries of the land, even though they're not persecuted, for example. And we have to rethink the whole stuff about the kind of rights we have to stop people. What we can say to someone who expresses a radical thought, why can't anybody have the right to live anywhere in the world? And of course we know that can't be the case. But we have to give up the way we now talk about being hosts to people. That can't quite be right if you recognise the sheer contingency of your luck in this place.
So what you're saying is at the end of the day we're going to have to find a way to maintain our sovereignty whilst we...
But sovereignty isn't the deepest issue. If we recognise the need for roots, then, and if these things are based not just on the, I mean, that's, they say pride in one's country, are based not on sort of necessarily the universal values of equality and so on, but those values as inflected by the spirit of the people, as that is in their landscape, in their song and so on. All those particularities, right? As egalitarianism is inflected in a distinctively Australian way, for example, in this country. I don't want to take up too much time. If I give a simple example of this, a few years ago, when a famous Melbourne personality, Dini O'Hearn, died, the funerals at Newman Chapel, I was going to say over here because I thought it was Melbourne University. Anyway, at Melbourne Chapel, it filled up very quickly, and my wife and I sat on the steps outside. Then the foreign secretary. came. I don't know if he had an entourage or if he didn't have an entourage, but if he did, it wasn't noticeable. And he just sat down on the steps without any suggestion that it might occur to him to do otherwise. And I thought, where else but Australia could this happen? And that's what I mean by a universal value here, let's say equality, inflected in a very distinctively Australian idiom. And if those things need to be protected, then it will be true that they need to be protected from people who have no sense of them at all,
so,
or lost.
Can I ask Dennis and Madeline into this conversation then? Is this like the crucible of that discussion? Should we, in our democracy, be having the conversation now about how we will deal, using the values that we hold dear in our democracy, with what's to come?
I listened to Ray with great interest because I think he has opened up a profoundly interesting and important line of discussion, because I think what Ray has challenged us to do is to think with a great deal more honesty and clarity and integrity about what we think Australia actually does stand for. What sort of a nation are we really? And I don't think we've come to terms with that in relation to the Indigenous people. And when it comes to these sorts of issues, I'm not sure that we don't, in a sense, believe our own propaganda to some extent.
It's not actually coming from us, perhaps.
And that we, as a nation, need to really confront some pretty uncomfortable truths about ourselves and think, is this the sort of society we really want? What are the values that we really hold dear? And how then should that play out in the policies of our government? And I think that's a huge challenge, and we are a long, long way, I think, from even beginning to face up to it.
Madeline?
I agree it's an essential conversation to be had, and its very practical demonstration is in the settlement services that are provided to people once they've got here, because we focus a huge amount of attention on keeping people out of the country at all means possible. As mentioned, perhaps compromising our own values in the process of trying to protect them by keeping people out. The reality is these people coming and needing our protection is not a threat to our way of life. It's not a threat to our values. But we need to focus on what happens next once they're here. How are they integrated into society properly? How are they supported? And while not being perfect, this is something on which Australia traditionally really is a world leader. Mm-hmm. Together with countries like Canada, historically speaking, Australia has done very well at the multicultural project, much better than some other countries. Mm. So rather than moving back from that, we should perhaps be leaning in, building on our positives,
yes,
what few there are, and moving forward that way.
The great schizophrenia of Australia. Okay, well, it's time now to ask you to have a question. So who would like to ask the first question? There.
I was just wondering, to what degree do the speakers think that our government is motivated by fear of Islam amongst our politicians and journalists on the same day as Pauline Hanson did her second maiden speech? I was at a conference around the corner where ex-politicians and some of our highest ranked journalists were listening to speeches called things like Ex Oriente Nox, Out of the East Comes Darkness, and they seem to believe in an existential threat to the West. And I'm wondering, do you think that's motivating our politicians?
Great question.
Well, to the extent that there's a vote in it, you'll forgive my cynicism. I don't think any sensible person thinks that Islam, that there's a kind of war of civilizations in which Australia's been caught up. I don't think any of our thinking politicians believe that for one moment. But it's a powerful political tool, and I don't think that some of our politicians anyway are too ashamed to use it. It's much the same, I think, with the race card generally. The race card wasn't played in Australia from about the 1960s until basically John Howard in the mid-1990s. It was considered to be just too dangerous. I think we're living with the legacy of that now, and I see this in much the same vein. It's exploitable as political currency, but I don't think there's any conviction behind it.
Ray, Madeline?
Well, look, I think it's obvious that our politicians believe that we have reason, and indeed we do have reason, to fear some people who profess their motives to be derived from their understanding of Islam. I mean, that's just not contestable. Mm. What's also not contestable is that most of the people in the world who also profess to be motivated by beliefs they take to be Islamic don't believe that. I think we should leave it. What I think is foolish is for politicians to get into a theological debate, effectively, to say they know what true Islam is, you know, or true Christianity, or what true Judaism is. The texts of all these religions have enough horrific passages in them to make anybody's hair stand on end, you know. So my view is just report the facts. Most Muslims in this country, overwhelmingly majority, are no danger to us. Some kids might be, and that's a police matter. It's not a matter of national security. Mm. It's a policing matter.
Do you want to respond to it?
I don't pretend to know how politicians think or what motivates them, so I'll defer to wiser minds.
Join the group, yes. Next question, please.
Thank you so much. Could you please talk a bit more to the point that was brought up towards the end about basically Australia's original sin, that we've never come to terms with willfully with genocide and displacing people who actually own the land?
I'm very sorry.
The question was, has Australia come to terms with the original sin of what we did to the Indigenous people?
A long time, it will be a long time coming, because I mentioned Paul Keating's "We," you know, we did the killings, we took the children, and so on, a "we" of national fellowship, and the big question for the inhabitants of Australia, I put it in that way, is what kind of "we" can be said between the non-Aboriginal inhabitants of this country and the Aboriginal inhabitants that is truthful to the history of their dispossession. And non-Aboriginal Australians won't fully understand the wrong done to the Aboriginal peoples. Won't understand that, if not under international law, morally speaking, they are still under occupation. They have not conceded anything. Right? Won't understand that fully unless they are prepared to accept that at the end of the road, when there is the discussion of what kind of "we" can be said, it might not be "we Australians." It might have to, maybe the only truthful "we" that can in the end be said with Aboriginal peoples and the non-Aboriginal peoples, truthful to the history of the dispossession, will have to involve a change of name of the country.
I think we're going to have to get... I'm so sorry, but I think we'll need to...
It relates entirely to your puzzlement as to why people don't care. I think it's a willful symptom, a psychotic displacement. The asylum problem is a psychotic displacement of this original problem.
Right. Did everyone heard that?
Do you want to address that?
No, I think we need to... That's been heard and partially discussed, but for time purposes, we'll have to go to the next question. Thank you. Up there.
Hello, and thank you very much for your presentation. My question is about the generation gap, and in particular, I feel that younger people care more about these issues from my perspective than my parents' generation, and certainly their immigrant friends. Partly because they believe that when the government on either side says that this is the policy, they believe it, whereas the younger people tend to be more cynical. I wonder if you can talk to that.
Dennis.
Well, perhaps based on that focus group work where we did organise the groups into mixed gender, but We had three different age categories, and we had them in different parts of Australia, and we had them from different socioeconomic groups. I'm not sure that is the important variable, actually. It seems to be much more associated with levels of education, which is a very good proxy for income and occupation and socioeconomic status generally, because it goes back to that point I mentioned earlier about a sense of a stake in Australian society and and people's perceptions of insecurity. That is a more powerful variable than the age variable. I heard sentiments of great toleration for asylum seekers among the young, but I heard that most powerfully actually from rather well-off retired people from the North Shore of Sydney rather than from young people. So I don't think it's really mainly an age thing. I think it's more about this sense of stake in society.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Thank you. I recently heard Gillian Triggs talking about a need for a charter of human rights in Australia, and that would in some ways ameliorate the treatment of the asylum seekers. I'd be interested to know what the panel thought about that.
So would I. Go ahead, Madeline.
Absolutely. It's essential, not only because of what it says about the culture of the nation and shifting the values that we've spoken about already, but because it's essential that if a wrong has been done by someone, they have a law that they can take to court to remedy it. Because until you start having these rights be enforceable in a court, they're going to continue to be, I guess, compromised in the various ways that we've already seen. So it's incredibly important for that very practical reason, I think.
Okay. Yeah, Raymond?
Well, I think we should have a Bill of Rights, but I also would say that rights need to be embedded in a more concrete moral language, which can reveal to us what it really means to suffer the violation of a right. And if that's not done, then it becomes far too abstract. And it's not going to make anybody care to know that someone's rights have been violated. What they need to know is more concretely what it means to suffer the wrong that has been done in that violation of a right. And I think the way we now rely on talk of rights, especially human rights, is a sign of a developing, as it were, illiteracy in an ethical vocabulary which would give much more substance to talk of rights. There's a wonderful passage in a book by a woman who said that we should talk much more about obligation to need than we should talk about the respect of rights. But she has a piece. This was written in just before the end of the Second World War. Her name is Simone Weil, and she says, "Look, if a farmer is haggling over the price of eggs, he can say I have a right to sell my eggs for whatever I want, price I want." She goes on to say, "If a young girl's going to be is being dragged into a brothel, she's not going to be talking about her rights. That would be absurd." And the reason she says that is not because it would be practically absurd, right? But because to say, for God's sake, can't you see what you're doing? You're violating her rights is absurdly inadequate to an understanding of what that girl is suffering.
Can we just nip back to Madeline for a sec, Dennis, because she wanted to add something?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's an incredibly important point that's being made, which is that we've got an immature discourse in this country about what rights are and what they mean to us and what they should be, and that absolutely needs to be grappled with. And just implementing a Charter of Rights tomorrow does not deal in any way with any of these issues, but it would perhaps start the conversation, which will probably be a very long conversation, as mentioned, about who we are as a country. Just flash into the very practical implementation, as I mentioned. The Supreme Court of Papua New Guinea earlier this year ruled that the detention centre on Manus Island was unconstitutional and illegal under the PNG constitution, which, like that of Nauru, has a full Bill of Rights in it. Whereas the litigation in Australia was going through all these sort of loops and turns and odd administrative attempts at trying to rule something unlawful, where what you're just trying to say is this is wrong. You're arbitrarily detaining someone. But we didn't have the law to, I think, start advancing that conversation about where we stand as a country on that.
Yes. I don't disagree with anything that either of the panellists have said. I would just add that I think the value of a Charter of Human Rights is that it provides a constitutional bedrock below which governments are not permitted to go, and it empowers the courts to draw lines which at the moment are very ill-drawn. If I just very quickly refer to the particular human right which is closest to my professional background, which is the free speech right. The High Court had to turn itself inside out to establish that we had the right of free speech on matters of government and politics. And they say explicitly that's not an individual right. That is the right of the community to engage in an exchange of information on matters of government and politics. So you can see how imperfect our present arrangements are.
We have to leave it there because we've run out of time, but could you please join me in thanking our three wonderful panellists, Madeline Gleeson, Dennis Muller and Raymond Gaiter.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.